Hello and welcome to Film Interrupted. My name's Jack.
My name's Martin.
My name's Nick.
Each of us have a list of shame compiled by using the IMDb Top 50 as a guide. Each of us looking at the films from that list the others hadn't seen and making a list of six films that we feel they should have seen by now, something missing from their cinematic experience. Here is a way to like give each other a friendly needling or just to try and make sure that each of us has seen the films that we deserve to see, films that we love and we want the others to have seen and experienced. We decided to do Monsters, Inc. from Martin's list. You're a new father, so do you want to try and explain your attitude towards watching Monsters, Inc.? Maybe as a new father, how do you feel about that?
I think it was relevant because I don't think I would have had the same kind of emotional response to the film, given the kind of, there's a sort of a protective kind of father-son relationship going on between Sully and Boo. So yeah, it brought a kind of extra element to it. I definitely got some of the humour a bit more because little things like him laying a trail of food for her, like the Cheerios. My kid will eat Cheerios off the floor all day. He leaves them as like little surprises for himself later, like, hey, good idea passed me, I've got some Cheerios. He didn't know about this. So yeah, it was a nice element. I think inherently becoming a dad, it makes you that little bit softer, a little bit more emotional, a bit more empathetic. So it did, you know, sort of play into my thoughts quite often, just, you know, seeing a kind of a recognition of how, you know, of how kids behave being depicted, you know, quite accurately and quite affectionately in Monsters, Inc. So no, that was definitely an element in my viewing. In terms of my reaction, if it is a kind of a comedy, which was kind of how I was approaching it first of all. I was like, I haven't seen this. It's a hugely successful animated film, kind of kids' film. There was a part of me that was sitting there thinking, this isn't that funny, this isn't making me laugh that much. I'm kind of pleased about that, you know? I felt like it was... But I did get won over a bit. I think that as a studio, Pixar are very, very good at bringing across... They're very good at doing sentimentality without it being overplayed or cynical.
They are, yes.
It works in a quite honest way of, you know, childhood's a great thing. Isn't it wonderful to experience it? Isn't it kind of sad that it's a brief thing as well? And yeah, just in the way that, you know, say Sully's sort of relationship with Boo is, you know, kind of instant and then is threatened by the kind of, you know, his expulsion, and it's always going to be a, you know, a kind of fleeting thing. Yeah, it's emotional for me. Yeah.
Yeah. I know what you mean about the humour. I hadn't seen this.
Billy Crystal's just not that funny.
No, I think he pulled off his role. I think he did what he was asked to do in that role.
Exactly, that is... but it's a kind of it's a middle-aged guy, you know, hamming up for a kids' movie, and it's not even a middle-aged guy who's like remotely relevant to, like, you know, films these days. You know, so it felt like they kind of hauled him back in, like, you know, oh, we don't have anyone to host the Oscars again, we'll wheel him out, you know?
Yeah.
That's the kind of feeling that I got from it. I suppose I am watching it, you know, like, what, 12 years after it first came out, so there's a bit of detachment there, but even so.
I think back then, it's still a very busy vaudeville performance, you know, that's comes dangerously close to, like, Timon and Pumbaa from The Lion King, at least in the beginning. But I think he does settle into the role eventually. But I think the storytelling does a lot to actually win you over to Mike. Particularly, I don't think I was ever really on board with Mike until Boo was on board with Mike.
Did you withhold your approval?
Yeah. I was kind of dubious about him until she took a fondness to him and started, like, claiming his name as, like, her catchphrase.
Yeah.
The humour is Yeah, it's of a certain tone. You said vaudeville, I'd agree with that. Or maybe just like a laugh track sitcom. And I get, you're not going to get a belly laugh from any of this movie.
They won back a laugh from the vaudeville thing because I think when Mike does his wee, like, kind of impromptu song and dance to try and, like, cover for being caught by what's the name of the character voiced by Steve Buscemi?
Randall.
When he's trying to, like, you know, cover up for Boo, and Randall catches him, and, you know, Mike does the little kind of, you know, song and dance, and it's, you know, got to get that thing out of there. Yeah. I really liked it when they kind of reprised it at the end and made it the kind of the company play. I thought that was really nice. I thoroughly enjoyed that.
This is still in the era where Pixar were doing the blooper reels at the end of the movies.
That's the worst thing ever.
It's a weird concept for me to, like, you know, to set out and make, like, a group of, like, purposely constructed bloopers. It's very unusual.
It's heinous.
Why do you dislike it so much?
Are you... You've been serious?
Yes.
It's the worst. It's deplorable.
You don't think it's funny?
No.
I didn't laugh during any of the ones from Monsters, Inc., but the ones on Bugs Life made me belly laugh. I remember that really specifically. The first time I saw those, they had me, like, in stitches.
It's such bad taste. Like, it's just... I don't know. It's so poorly conceived. I can't even describe it because it's such a visceral reaction for me of just disgust. It's like...
I can hear you talking through your teeth right now. You know, you mentioned it.
Yeah.
He does look disgusted. I can confirm that for you.
Okay. So is it specifically in the case of Monsters, Inc., or is it in any kind of Pixar film where they try and pull that trick on you?
To be honest, I don't even recall them having done it before or since. You mentioned A Bug's Life. I don't think I've seen A Bug's Life.
No, I haven't either. My only experience of A Bug's Life was at Disneyland.
Yeah.
Which was quite a good kind of, you know, 4D experience.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was...
Not a patch on Captain EO, but, you know, still.
Yeah, Captain EO's the bomb.
A complete lack of sincerity, and I don't approve at all.
You're like, kids shouldn't be exposed to this kind of cynicism.
Yeah, it feels cynical. It does feel cynical. It's the closest the comedy comes to being... You know, it's almost like something you would see in a DreamWorks cartoon. It's like, by the numbers, lowest common denominator. I'm ashamed of you for liking it.
I really enjoyed the company play, but I thought it was...
I thought
it was kind of one of those joke effects where it didn't really work at first, and then they kind of did it again, and it didn't really work, but they just kept, like, ploughing through it, and, like, you will eventually laugh at this joke, and they got me. I did.
And I guess I just don't like it when they show anything over the credits. I think as soon as the credits are run, it should be white credits on black screen, and you should leave. You know, I really don't like when they put extra stuff in. Annoys me.
I love extra stuff during the credits. That's my favourite part of, like, any Marvel movie, is just sitting there on my ass waiting for the tiny bit at the end. Like, whatever it is with Tony Stark and, you know, the Hulk having a chat. But with the picture...
Did you see the picture of Robert Downey Jr. Visiting the little kid?
No, what happened?
Oh, you should research it. Robert Downey Jr. was at a kid, I think it was like 7th birthday, and his mum had told us, like, you're going to meet Iron Man, but he didn't turn up in, like, the Iron Man costume, so there's, like, this picture of a kid, like, sitting in a wee, like, maybe, like, a wee cart or that kind of thing, and he's just crying his eyes out, and Robert Downey Jr. just has this, like, stone face, just like, oh god, I've ruined this child's life.
Yeah.
And I think they rescued it, but there's a brilliant picture of, like, this kid with, like, his head kind of buried off to the side, and Robert Downey Jr. just, like, looking absolutely, like, gutted. That's fantastic.
That does sound like something I want to see.
I'll find it. I'll show you a link.
Okay, we'll do that.
But yeah, I was doing the rounds in the papers here.
Did you... When we were putting these lists together, like, I'd said that you had, a big lack of Pixar in your life. Is it something you've avoided or just haven't got around to?
I mean, it's not something I've intentionally avoided. I just think it's an effect where, basically, the age that I am, I felt I was a bit too old to be bothering with, you know, going to the cinema or, you know, seeking out, you know, particularly, you know, kids' animated films. Don't have, like, other young children, like, in my family. So, I mean, now I've got a 1-year-old boy, you know, obviously that kind of thing's going to change and there'll be, you know, a lot more, like, kid stuff that I'm going to be exposed to. But yeah, I think it was just a fact of, you know, being of an age where I wasn't really, you know, looking for that kind of, you know, entertainment, and there wasn't, like, a kid in the family kind of thing where I was, you know, obliged to actually watch that. That was all, really. I mean, there's... I think I saw The Lion King maybe 2-3 years ago. And, like, for everyone I went to uni with, you know, that was like, oh my god, that's one of the favourite films of my childhood. And I was a bit older, so I'd never even seen it. So my wife, you know, made me watch it. But, no, I thoroughly enjoyed it. But it's just animated films of, say, late 90s to, you know, 2010, that kind of time. Mm. No, I just wasn't really looking out for them. I saw Toy Story 2, Toy Story 3, thought they're magnificent, but it didn't really inspire me to go looking beyond that too much, in all honesty.
It's just the consistency that, well, I don't think this is true in the last 5 years, but the consistency that Pixar had in producing films that were really top rate was unparalleled for about 10 years. And it, looking back on it, it was shocking. And I think, Nick, you and I talked about this, that probably at one point they were just undoubtedly the best picture house in production.
Yeah, certainly. Certainly the most reliable.
Yeah, just like film after film. And looking at the amount of stuff you hadn't seen, I wasn't sure which one to recommend to you. I was keen to recommend The Incredibles, because The Incredibles is not an atypical Pixar movie. It's very different from the rest. But it's probably the best superhero movie of that era by like head and shoulders. It's like a phenomenal superhero movie. But I didn't want to start like recommending things that weren't typical for Pixar. And you talk about the warmth and the affection, the characters that kind of like evoked for you in the relationships. And I think that's key to what Pixar have to offer you in feature films. And I think that Monsters, Inc. is the best example of that. And the humour might be vaudeville, it might be a bit, you know, a laugh track sitcom, but just the warmth and the love in that movie make it, for me, it's more than just a kid's movie. I'll make the distinction between a kid and a family movie, where a kid movie is that thing that only a kid has the patience to watch, of Care Bears the movie. You know, it's like no one in the family wants to see it, but it's got something branded for kids, and that kid's going to watch that. But something family orientated is where the filmmaker has got the courtesy and the skill to try and appeal to the entire family without patronizing anyone. And it's just a huge skill. I can't underestimate that enough. Are you going to try and... Are you looking forward to seeing more Pixar?
Yeah, I would say so. I'd be happy to, you know, to have a look at them, you know, at any time, and I think it'll be fun to... I mean, I don't really want to go and watch, like, all those films, you know, over the next few months and have seen everything for Pixar. I'm perfectly happy to kind of leave them and say it's inevitable that I'll watch all these with my kids.
Yeah,
or,
yeah,
you know, for their kids many times, you know. Kids don't have any problem with repeat viewing, you know, every day, every week, whatever. If they like it, they like it. So I don't really want to, you know, go and see like the Pixar canon and then, you know, just like, okay, I'll be watching this for the next like, you know, 8 years, 10 years, you know, that kind of thing. But yeah, I won't have like any kind of trepidation about it, you know. It'll be absolutely fine. It's not going to be like, you know, having to sit and watch like, you know, Masters of the Universe, you know, for the next like, 10 years, that kind of thing.
Yeah, Kiyomi and I, my wife and I, have talked about having what we're going to be like as taste enforcers for our kids. We're basically going to be Nazis and like, no, you can't watch this because I said so. How far are you going to go into that when it comes to your turn?
Yeah, that's something that I will definitely do. I'm not going to spend my life, like, you know, pandering to the whims of children and end up watching like utter dreck over and over again. You know, I mean, basically, our intention for our kids is that they don't watch like TV or films at all before they're like, you know, age two, because they just won't deal with it, and it will, you know, mess with their attention span. There's myriad documented reasons for just, you know, giving them time to actually learn about, you know, the physical world before you start extrapolating that into, you know, animation and to film that are just, you know, bombard them with such, you know, sensory overload that other things just pale into insignificance. I like that my kid is really happy sitting and looking at a book, and that from, you know, 7 months old he was like turning pages in a book. That's really nice for me, you know, and he's got plenty of time to sit and watch crap all his life, because God knows I did. So.
Yeah, guilty as charged.
But yeah, I've got no interest in, you know, sitting through whatever the equivalent of, you know, Peppa Pig or Power Rangers would be. Gah, no, I don't want to play that game.
No, I don't blame you. Nick, before we get into this, actually, let me just explain. We were discussing online at one point what should be in these lists, and I made the classic online discussion mistake of going into a rant without realising it on Facebook about why we should have Monsters, Inc. on Martin's list rather than Finding Nemo.
It's more of an essay.
Yeah,
that was a little unnerving.
I apologise for that. That was just me being impassioned, and then looking back on it like a day later, like, oh, I just did that. Sorry. Did you think, on our last discussion, you said you thought this would be the film you'd recommend? I mean, is this your favourite Pixar film? Oh, how do you feel about it?
I don't know that it's necessarily, you know, head and shoulders above the rest, where I would say, you know, definitively this is the one that stands above all others. It was always one that I liked when I was younger, because I guess part of it was because it was sort of the unsung hero of, you know, the Pixar catalogue. It was the one that nobody talked about. And for me, it was like me and amongst my friends, we were all kind of into it, and we were, you know, we thought the characters were fun to hang out with, and we liked the world. When I revisited it, I think I would question why I had that reaction to it. I still love the film, but I love it in ways that maybe I can't identify from back then in myself. But yeah, so like, I was perfectly happy for you to show Martin it, but I think there are more essential, you know, Pixar films. There are ones that definitely made a bigger impact in the world, and would be like, it would garner more surprise amongst people when you told them that you hadn't seen them.
What age did you see this? I mean, I should clear this up. I think I'm 7 years older than you. No, not as much as that. I'm a few years older than you. What age were you when you saw this movie?
I guess when it first came out on DVD, when was it released?
2001, so probably 2002 on DVD.
So that would have been, what would that have been, 16, 17?
Not a kid per se, but it's still something you're still interested in, like, animated cinema at that point.
Yeah, for sure, like, as, you know, a film geek, you know, and as surrounded by friends who were into, you know, drawing and animation and things, so it was...
Mm.
And everyone saw Pixar. It was, you know, wasn't something that defined me as opposed to everyone else.
Yeah, I think.
So, what was the difference for you between, you know, your memory of what you loved about it and then revisiting it?
I think it was funnier in my memory. Like, I guess it was more fun for me to hang out in that world than it was for me revisiting it.
Yeah.
Like the world for me, I was surprised more revisiting it at how unimaginative the world is. Almost, it almost feels like our world, essentially. Like there's no difference. You'd almost expect from a Pixar film based on a monster's world that it would be kind of like the Addams Family or something, you know, where you would walk in and up would be down and down would be up, and you know, characters would be saying,
but no, it's a very precisely constructed kind of, you know, alternate kind of reality, but it's very structured within our own, you know, our own world.
Yeah, there's streets, there's cars, the dilemmas are based around, you know, workplace relationships.
It's just a kind of a basic technological kind of, you know, thing they have where you go through this door and that's it. That's the only kind of, you know, separation. And I mean, I kind of compared it favourably in my head. I mean, I didn't watch all of Wreck-It Ralph, but I watched maybe 40 minutes or so, and I thought it was awful. I really disliked it. I thought it was an unfunny, kind of nasty, cynical attempt to kind of cash in on people's nostalgia. And they use a kind of similar sort of style to kind of do the thing where there's the there's the video game characters who exist in the video game, but then, you know, the arcade closes and they all kind of retreat home down power lines and hang out together. You know, so there's a kind of broadly similar, you know, structure, but the Pixar one felt quite solid, you know? It's like there's a world of monsters, there's a doorway from their world to our world, and it's fine. The Wreck-It Ralph one was just really tenuous and shaky, and no one even goes to fucking arcades anymore.
But yeah, I think that the world that it's set in, as I say, is very much our world. You know, really isn't that different at all. So it creates a really firm foundation where you can believe these incredible things that happen. But the things that stand out and the things that probably don't work so well are the things that really indulge in the sort of Addams Family monstrous aspect of it, where you would have like them spraying on odorant instead of deodorant, where that just kind of feels out of place in this world, because there's no reason in this world why bad smells would appeal to them more than good smells, you know?
Yeah.
It's essentially the same place as our world, it's just got weirder people in it.
Yeah, I mean, it's all cars and, you know, they've got to go to work and stuff,
yeah.
But no, they've got bills to pay. You know?
They're happy when good things happen, they're upset when bad things happen, they have the same reactions as us. They're more, everything, every character in the film is less like an anthropomorphized monster and more like just an abstracted human. Like, it feels there's a very fine line there.
What do you think of John Goodman?
Awesome. I thought he was awesome.
Yeah, I mean, but agreeing with you, it wasn't ever like a stretch of the imagination to, you know, have, you know, John Goodman playing, you know, a big, cuddly, humorous, protective guy. You know, they made him furrier, you know?
There was, I can't remember where I heard it, maybe read it online, but they wanted Bill Murray for that role. Couldn't contact him to get him to do it, because he doesn't have an agent. He's basically a shutting in, and he lets, you know, Sofia Coppola knock on his door once every 5 years, basically. And so they were just like, oh, who are we going to get? And, like, whoever came up with John Goodman from Bill Murray, who made that jump, that's just great casting. And I think that deserves, like, plaudits. But yeah, just like you're saying, it seems like that is typecasting almost. It's like, if it was like a really twitchy, weird guy, you'd almost imagine they want to cast Jim Carrey and have him do the voice, but they had this really warm, protective, sweet guy who's perfectly embodied by John Goodman, and his baritone when he's playing with Boo in the bathroom stalls and pretending he doesn't know where he is, he's doing fee, fi, fo, fum, is the closest I got to a belly laugh when watching it and rewatching it. Just the embodiment of his character, I really enjoyed it and how warm it was. And it made me want to go out and buy a doll of Sully and have it in my room. Like, aww. But, you know, that's just another creepy road that I won't go down as a grown man with stuffed toys in his room. So, this... No, it's not. But the general point I'm trying to make is this film is... I talked about a distinction between family and kids films and how they're enjoyable for all, and I'll stand by that. I'll probably end up talking about that at some other point in some other podcast, but this is makes me feel just the joy of being a child, and you're talking about it too, and you know how great it is to be a child. I reached out to the child and it made me feel very childish, not very fatherly. But in a good way, I did. Still a really evocative film for me. I really enjoyed it.
So you would relate more with Boo?
I do. I don't know why. It's just I enjoy the company of Sully and what he means for that character. Just the warmth he has for her. But I do relate to Boo. I relate to this. I relate to this 3-year-old Asian girl. I think she's Asian.
Is she?
I don't know. Is she?
I don't think she's white. Okay. I thought she was just kind of cartoonish, but no, I didn't apply any kind of, you know, ethnicity beyond, you know, oh, she's, you know, a white kid in a cartoon form.
You don't have to defend yourself to me, Martin. Jack's already shown himself up, so we can judge him, but you're all right.
Good.
But yeah, I don't know why. I just...
I have a feeling that'll become like a regular feature on the show, like accidental racist card.
regular feature. And this week on Accidental Racist Cards, Jack makes a blackface comment. You know, what's the big deal? What's the big deal? Really? Come on.
We've all done it.
Yeah. But I can't think of any other movie with a child protagonist I identify with that much. And she's not even a protagonist. It's Sully's clearly the protagonist, and I identify with Boo really heavily.
Think for me, like the film definitely works on me in a more directly as Pixar potentially intended, at least for people who don't have children. But like Sully's the audience surrogate for me, at least. I mean, did you feel like you were really well? I mean, you're a father, so you probably would have related to Sully and his relationship with.
Yeah, I felt that he was the kind of the core of the film, really. That, you know, he's the hero for the monsters, and he's the protector of the kid, and you know, he's the, you know, sort of the guy who's, you know, leading the business and, you know, saves the company and, you know, turns everything around from, you know, screams to laughs and that kind of thing. Yeah, he's definitely the you know, the head honcho of the film.
Sure. Yeah, and I think he's quite easy to get on board with. I think even though the film does a good job of convincing you that this world, like, there really is no surprise in Sully being someone who would be attentive to this little girl. Like, you see his, you know, his massive monstrous, you know, height and his fur and his fangs and all that, and, you know, they play up later how scary he can be, you know, to children when he lets himself go. So for me, the thing that I find touching in the film is, you know, just the image of this monstrous, you know, horrible figure being so sweet to this little girl. I think for me, like, I have a different relationship with kids than you guys do.
That sounds so wrong. You should say something different.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's say that kids freak me out.
Okay, that's a good clarifier.
Yeah. Like,
why do they freak you out?
They're just weird. Like, I like them when they're Nathan's age, but as they get older, they just get, like, scary. Like, have you seen... I recently watched Thomas Vinterberg's The Hunt.
No, I've heard it's good, but go on.
Oh, it's ace, but it's about a little girl who accuses her kindergarten teacher of showing her his penis, and he hasn't. She's made it up, and the whole film is about the torture that he suffers from the community after this, and... Mm-hmm. It's absolutely horrifying, and she's like the scariest, the most, because you can't get sense out of her, you know. Yeah. She said it and the parents are like, why would you say it if it didn't happen, you know? It's
because children are inherently self-indulgent and haven't, you know, learned yet that you don't just exist to please yourself and entertain yourself.
This is actually pretty funny. The other, I was down in London a couple of weeks ago and we were getting the train back. And we were kind of sitting behind this this family. It was like a dad and two daughters. One daughter was maybe 8 and the other one was maybe 3. And I was actually mad when we walked in. There was like a table full of sweets. Like, I've never seen so many sweets in like a 2-liter bottle of regular Coke. I was like, okay, this is going to be fun. But it was like one of the few seats we could get that was facing forwards. And I'd hate travelling backwards on the train for 4.5 hours. So we ended up sitting directly behind them. But as we pulled into one of the stations on the way back, there was like another train on the track beside us that was heading the other direction, but it was obviously stopped as well to let people on. And it was actually the little girls who'd pointed this out, but there was like, it was pretty horrible. Like, the train had stopped so that we could look out and see the end of it. And it was almost like there was a windscreen wiper on that part of the train, and this bird had been caught in it, and like, its feathers had been sprayed up like a fan, and it was massive. And we were looking at it going, Jesus Christ. And, you know, like, and Emma was like, no, that's a bird of prey. Look at those talons and all that. And then the wee girl in front just, like, looks at her sister and goes, I killed that bird. It was pretty funny, but you know how you go, what is this world that they live in? That's in any way a sensible thing to say.
Uh-huh.
So kids kind of have to do some heavy lifting to win me over when they're when they're presented in films like this.
No, they do lie a lot, you know.
Yeah,
I haven't heard anything like that. I've heard like the kind of thing where you're just like sitting in a bus and you'd like drive past a deli and like there's like, you know, giant salamis and hams and stuff hanging in the window and like a wee kid will just say like, I had that for my dinner last night, I ate a whole one. Of course you didn't, you're not even Italian.
So when I'm watching Monsters, Inc., like, for me, my visceral reaction is...
She's going to, like, check, you know, brand Sully as a pedo or something.
Like, the fact that Sully's on board with this kid kind of... it kind of gives me some hope for her, and it eases me into a relationship with that character during the course of the film.
That's nice. I mean, Sully's a good kind of guide for that, because, you know, he's just a classic hero. I mean, he's, you know... He's like he's brilliant at his job, which obviously you know every hero has to be, and you know he's got a good moral core and everything. It's a very classical kind of feeling film. If the story of it would be totally at place being made, you know, in the 40s, you know.
How do you think the animation stood up on this? Because we were talking recently about one. Okay, my favorite film, hands down, top three is Toy Story. And I know that Nick had said he saw it on television recently and the animation just didn't stand up. And I'd agree with that, but it doesn't bother me. Do you think that it stands up in Monsters, Inc.?
Was it like a kind of standard definition thing? Or?
Oh yeah, it was on ITV, so it would have been...
If it's a bit ropey and you're watching it on a, you know, a kind of flat panel TV these days, then the transition's really awkward. So yeah.
I think the film, I think Monsters, Inc. looks good.
I think it still looked a nice film.
The parts that are supposed to look impressive, like all the fur that moves about, looks good.
I mean, I downloaded it and I didn't get like a, you know, an HD copy or anything like that. I just, you know, upscaled it through Xbox and yeah, it looked nice. It didn't feel dated or anything. There wasn't, you know, any kind of awkward moments where I thought, this looking really ropey.
I think there is one. I think it's the crab guy. I think he looks awful.
He has aged a little. Well, this is my thing. This is what I'm getting at. Is do you think...
I just don't think he was a very well-drawn or thought-out character.
No.
I don't think that's a kind of technological thing. I just...
I think if he were a bit showy with the lighting on him, his skin looks weird. It's kind of a technological showpiece to have all this light on him all the time.
I guess, he does kind of stand out like a sore thumb because he is probably, like, the only kind of, like, horrific-looking monster that's actually in the film. The rest of them, I mean, I guess... Randall's a bit slimy and reptilian, but nothing too worrisome. But yeah, he's definitely the most visually unappealing character by quite some distance.
Yeah. Did you like Lord Jack?
No, I mean, I agree with you. He was just like, I think you're talking about video games, and that seems like he's something out of a video game, but I agree with that. The rest of the characters seemed fine to me, but what I'm concerned about is that Pixar, and maybe even CGI films in general, tend to release each film as a sort of a benchmark as here, this is what we can do now. Now, this is what we can achieve. And I'm worried that that's going to affect maybe not how we look back on films in terms of quality. You get some sort of antiquated animation styles, and that rarely affects people's enjoyment of them. That's just what was done at that time for a hand-drawn style. But with CGI going the way it is, I'm worried that products which might appear really good now, you might look back on that as sort of crude, as just, you know, bad CGI animation.
I think it's a possibility, but I would expect with pretty much any art form that the great ones will remain great, and I don't think there'll be, you know, too much revision of, you know, I mean, I think Toy Story's got a very safe place in, you know, the canon of, you know, great kids films for all time. And the rest will just, you know, they'll be evaluated by, you know, their own merits rather than whether it still looks, you know, shiny enough.
Well, that's a concern. I'm not sure. I hope not. I think that's really shallow, but maybe what I'm trying to say is I'm worried I'll look back on that and like, oh, that looks so crude. And I don't know if it'll ruin my enjoyment of it. That said, I mean, I see Toy Story once every 6 months and it's never even registered that it looked dated until you mentioned it. And it honestly didn't even occur to me.
I'm sorry.
If you're looking at maybe a scene in an isolated way or when you just start watching it, But I think it's so well crafted that, you know,
yeah,
you just get drawn in.
I didn't rewatch the whole film. Like, I only watched sequences, and there's a lot of bare carpet, you know, with only the two main characters in the middle of it, and it just feels a little bit...
I think with something like Monsters, Inc., though, that you're talking about, so much of the content is just, like, this is a monster. This is a monster who's funnier. This is a monster who's scary, because they're animated or drawn in a certain way. I'm worried how Monsters, Inc. will age. Something like Finding Nemo, I don't think that's got any problem. I think that'll age quite well. But Monsters, Inc. is so... I think it depends on aesthetics quite a lot for a lot of its content. And I'm not sure, having rewatched it, how it's going to age. It's a concern for me.
It might not age that well for you, but it won't be a problem for like subsequent generations of kids. Yeah. Kids are actually very forgiving when it comes to, you know...
That's true. They are, yeah.
The sort of, you know, acceptance of, you know, a fantastical, you know, sort of, you know, depiction. Generally, just that if it looks okay, then, yeah, I mean, that's fine.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I'm eventually going to try and show my kids, like, I don't know, The Forbidden Planet, you know, when they're old enough to take how weird that is, and that sort of, like, 1980s French animation... And that's going to be well out of vogue by then, I'm sure. So,
Kid's watching Dogtanyan. He doesn't have a choice.
It's going to be true. How long was that show? I remember watching it as a kid. And like, epic. It's still on.
Yeah, like that ran for a long, long time. There's a lot of Dogtanyan to get through. There's a lot of plot.
The Cities of Gold.
Yeah, I don't even know if the Cities of Gold ever actually came to a conclusion or not. It seemed to exist for my entire childhood.
I think this is before your time, is that right, Nick?
Yes.
Yes, okay. But yeah, we're off subject again. Sorry, okay. I did that. Did you have any final thoughts on Monsters, Inc. before we wrap this up and talk about next week?
One thing that we could touch on that you'd mentioned that maybe I'm not quite so on board with is Randall. Like, I know Pixar have a reputation for not making bad guys that are as good as like the protagonists in their films. And I think that, to a certain extent, holds true in this film, but I know, Jack, you disagree.
With Randall?
Yeah.
I like Randall as an antagonist, is that what you mean?
Yes.
Yeah. yeah, I do, I think he's really good. I think it's maybe just the charming Steve Buscemi again. And I just like the fact that he's sleeker. I like his relationship with his flunky. It's nothing new. It's just he's someone he bullies and like gets his way with. But I just think he does a really good job.
That extractor kind of device, that felt like it was almost going a bit too far in terms of like the kind of, you know, kind of scary aspect for like, you know, little kids.
Mm.
I didn't like the thought of like, you know, someone like extracting terror from children.
Yeah, that's fair.
I found that quite disturbing.
Yeah, well, I'm almost disappointed that it's mechanical, though. Like, I feel like there should have been a more creative way to approach that concept of, like, exposing a child to its worst possible fear to extract the terror from them. It seems like that's something that is inspired, like, if you were to go that route. It's making a different film from the one that we've got. But, you know, it could inform her relationship with Sully then, if it was to expose some sort of fear of being removed from Sully or something. You know, it seems like that's a more creatively satisfying way to approach that concept than just have it be mechanical.
Yeah. But I mean, I think the mechanical aspect of, you know, what I already thought was quite a potentially, you know, upsetting thing for a kid to see. I think if you're actually going to like kind of room 101 these children,
yeah,
and find out what like their absolute like terror like point is, then you're not making a Pixar film anymore.
That's true. Well, kids have weird fears. So
yeah, maybe you could have got away with that in the '80s, you know.
Yeah,
and we covered like, you know, Return to Oz. I think that'd be absolutely fine in that era to like,
yeah,
you know, do a room 101 for kids. And, you know.
For me, I do like Randall. I think Randall's like a cool character. He's like, he's one of the most like irredeemable characters that you're going to see in a Pixar film. Like, he's so bad-natured, like, to his very core. And he's like, he's an intimidating presence, even though like he's not physically intimidating. He's just sort of wily and he can vanish and appear. He creeps you out. But I think, like I say, I just think that whole subplot and like the whole Energy Crisis subplot feels a little bit uninspired. Like, it doesn't feel like it's at the heart of the film. For me, the film really begins and really takes off the moment that Boo meets Sully. And while, you know, that the relationship with Randall doesn't strike me as being a particularly good antagonistic relationship, the extent of antagonism in the film, like the fact that they have this child in a world where children are feared and, you know, have this whole, there's this whole swarm of people who want to take Boo off of Mike and Sully. Like, just the cumulative effect of everything that's out to get them is something that I find compelling. If Randall maybe doesn't necessarily strike me as being completely essential to the storytelling of the film, like, I almost feel like he could be removed and you would have essentially, if not the same story, a very similar story.
So you just think he was there as sort of a compulsion to have someone to focus all that on?
Yeah, and I think he's good. Like, if that's the route you're going down, I think I struggle to think of, you know, a better villain, you know, in that sense, like, and just a purely, like, in terms of a look, in terms of a performance. I think Steve Buscemi really nails it, but I don't know if maybe they could have done some more work to even ditch the Energy Crisis story and work on something.
It did feel a bit too constructed, that, you know, we need a motivator, you know, for this story to, you know, help out, because we're a bit thin on, you know, actual story. I'd agree with you on that point.
But the best sequence in the whole film, the one that I just absolutely adored, and I don't think it even stuck in my mind until I rewatched it, was, like, it's from the point where they first discover Boo. I think it begins just after they leave the sushi place and they're in the apartment and they're just getting to know Boo and, like, they're messing about. That apartment is amazing. Like, it feels like a kind of New York bohemian loft or something, but the lighting in it is amazing and the atmosphere is amazing. The place just feels so lived in. And you almost feel like if the rest of the film had taken place there, like in this apartment or in this complex where, like, there's a siege to try and get, you know, Boo, but they're not letting her go. It creates a world, or it makes a film where I'd rather spend time there than in the bland walls of Monsters, Inc. Even though the film is called Monsters, Inc. Oof. And there's an argument that there's almost like a Frederick Wiseman style, you know, boxing gym story about this industry. I feel like once you're in Monsters, Inc., you'd probably rather be anywhere else.
What do you think about the action sequence in the end? I didn't remember that being so awesome. But yeah, it's just like, wow, it's really, really well executed. And it made me laugh to see the Portal video game style physics in action. Like, years before the video game, someone had thought that out and put it into effect.
It really works. Like, when you watch, like, one of the Pixar shorts was Presto, where they do a similar idea with, like, a magician's hat and, you know, is it a fez at the other side?
It's like a sort of stereotypical cone hat with moons and stars on it. That comes out of, like, a top hat on the other side, maybe? Is that it?
Sure.
Yeah.
But that, I think, it kind of suffers from being a little bit too abstract, where you kind of lose sight of which way's up and which way's down, and it's difficult to get your bearings with it. But the fact that it's doors, and doors tend to have a very fixed position, so it makes sense on an instinctual level when you see someone walk into a door and walk out, or walk into a door in Monsters, Inc. and walk out in China, you know, then fall into, like, a horizontal door in Monsters, Inc., and then fly out a vertical door in, you know, Paris. they can get away with a lot because doors tend to be fixed in one place, whereas in Presto, you're kind of lost for most of it because the hats are changing direction every time someone reaches into it.
It's really good writing. Yeah, it's really strong. That's... Honestly, that's all I had to say about it. I could gush for another 15 minutes, but I won't put you through it. Like, I'm just...
You've got stuff that, you know, you haven't said yet, then. Yeah.
No, it's just
what we're here for. I mean, one thing, I don't really think... I mean, I got something from the film. I mean, it's a nice, you know, sort of warm kind of, you know, family feel to it. You know, I got that, but I don't feel that, you know, that having seen it, that it's like, you know, it's kind of, it's filled a void. It's like, Jesus Christ, I can't believe that I'd missed that. It's like, that's, you know, a reasonable animated comedy that had, like, you know, a nice warm kind of, you know, sentiment through it that, you know, it won me over through, like, you know, some good voice acting and a nice, you know, sort of, you know, father, you know, child relationship. I don't think it was, I was really seeing something that was new to me or that had been missing from, you know, background, you know, viewing.
I think that's about right. That's about what I expected. Sorry, Jack.
I'm really disappointed. I should have shown you Finding Nemo or something then, because I want that Pixar film that does that for you, because I know that there's one out there. One thing I know I could do for you is I could show you the first 15 minutes of Up and make you cry like a child.
Well, I've seen that, and it's a beautifully moving film. I've seen Up saw it in the cinema, and yeah, the start of that is just, it's heart-rending, you know? It really deals with death in a very upfront and honest way that you don't get in many kids' films.
No. I mean, this is a different subject, but I'll just talk about it very briefly, and that I think that was honestly the start of the end for the golden years of Pixar. The first act was fantastic, and then it's just slowly... It lost charm all the way through.
I was waiting to see the same thing. I didn't have much affection for the sort of adventure side of the story.
Yeah.
You know, I think it was overplayed. It was, you know, it was too thin. It seems like they had too good an idea for it to just be a short film.
Yeah.
But there wasn't, you know, anything that I really recollect, you know, after the first act. It was just that was the kind of prize of the film.
Well, that's where I get to show myself up for being a dick to you guys about the outtakes at the end of the film. But in Up, the talking dog, I love that dog.
Mm-hmm. Like, just like that. Is it the squirrel line or just the fact that he says "I love you" in like the third act?
Well, it's all good, you know. This is all good stuff. But, like, I think this is where I realise how much lowest common denominator comedy will work for me if it involves an animal.
So you're saying if the bloopers in the end of Monsters, Inc. had included a talking dog, you'd have been right behind it?
Yep.
Right. Okay, just so we can clear that up.
Think about it. Just in terms of, I don't want to harp on about the bloopers again, but just think back to the end of that film. Like, if you haven't seen the end of the film, skip. But he gets the missing piece of the door, he puts it in place, the door opens up, steps inside, Boo says, "Kitty," and he goes, and then there's the fucking bloopers immediately after that beautiful moment, that beautiful, tasteful resolution to this heartfelt relationship that's been blossoming through the whole film, and then I need to watch that Edna woman go, "Surprise!" Then ha 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 ha, beep, as the sound of the camera, or someone falling in slow motion. It's the worst.
Yeah, I feel bad for someone watching it for like the first time on TV, and, you know, they have like not only that to contend with, but they have, like, you know, the film being like squashed up into the top left corner, and they run adverts and all the rest of it, and someone talks over it as well. That's my, like, personal, like, greatest bugbear with the Film 4 TV channel here, that they, you know, they finish a film, and as soon as the last frame of the film is gone and the credits start to roll, they squash it all into a corner and they show adverts talking about how much they love film. We really love it, and we show this film no respect. We've shoved it off into a corner, but the other ones that are coming on next, oh, we love them more. Yeah, I hate that.
I kind of like that.
No, it's dreadful.
I like it because it gives me permission to turn the film off. Like, see, when a film ends, as soon as I see credits, my instinct is get this off right now. but I kind of feel like it's always like an uneasy feeling when the credits start, because it's like they might show something that is part of the film. You know, I get nothing from the credits. Like, people, snobs, will say, you know, you need to sit through the credits and read all the names.
I like to watch the cast, you know. I like to watch the cast. After the cast, I'm done. I'm not going to sit there for like 5 minutes and
to
watch
see who
like
colorized
a list of, like, you know, 700 animators.
Yeah.
And pretend that, you know, I care one bit about, you know, what they did.
Well, that was rude of me, apologies, but I do.
No, we're clearly in a middle ground, you know.
Yeah. I do it like
we're better than you, but we're not top tier.
I think that is very true.
Cuz I resent the Marvel thing. You said it's like your favorite bit.
Yeah.
I fucking hate that. Yeah. That, you know, they're like, you're going to have to sit through acres of information about people who've done like digitizing for special effects. I mean, the scope that these films require for, you know, to actually fit in all the names of people who are relevant to the production, it's ridiculous now. Yeah.
And the only interesting thing is like when you're watching it and you see like visual effects supervisor and you go, oh, his name's Colin McRae, that's weird. <You know>? just like an oddity. The rest of it, you're just completely numb watching these words that are completely meaningless to everybody but the person whose name is.
Yeah, it's for their family, but yeah. You know, unless you're married to someone who actually made the film or they're your kid, then you know, just get up and leave. You know?
I wonder if it's the same Philip Schofield who was a stunt coordinator on this film.
I watch credits, and it's the difference between being the GFT and the Cine World, okay? And I'll definitely watch credits on an art house film.
I think that puts you on an even like worse level than the generic title watching snob. That's dreadful.
I feel
you're just like you're just trying to like make the people in the GFT think that you're one of them, but really you're not. You just want to be part of the crowd.
I hate that feeling,
that's weak.
I don't think I've ever sat through a film in the GFT and felt comfortable. Like, I don't think it's a very welcoming environment. It is a very snobbish environment where you would sit down. And everyone wants you to behold how worthy, you know, they think this film is.
If you go to one of the kind of daytime kind of matinee one, there's no better place to go and watch like an old western, or that kind of thing.
Sure, I think that's fair.
That's really nice, but I get where you're coming from. Yeah,
but I think like for me personally, I know that you guys may disagree with this, but for me, film of all the art forms is the one that is for the masses. It's for that's why I don't have a problem with people eating popcorn during films or slurping juice. I don't think it's an elitist art form. I don't think it should be. So when you see films, it should be a kind of a welcoming experience. It's for people who can't afford or are disinterested in seeing things in the theatre. I think we all got ingratiated into film in that way. Film presented itself to us as kids as something that was, you know, something that would welcome us in, and I don't know. It's certainly when I sit in the GFT, I've never felt as if it's the place where I feel at home. And I guess in LA it would be the Arclight, I suppose.
The Arclight is I do both the highbrow and the lowbrow cinemas in LA for different reasons. But before we do that, to clarify, I sit through the credits of the GFT because I'm embarrassed to get up and go in case someone will top me. So it's more It's even pettier than wanting to be one of them.
It's That's disgraceful.
I know. But I do. I mean, I was just talking before we came on air that I go to the drive-in movie theater here to see movies there because it's just you can't beat the deal. It's $9, and it's two movies during the summer, and in the winter when the nights are longer, they give you three movies. So they do
Sorry to interrupt, Jack. Is it $9 per car or $9 per person?
Per person, but it's still a steal. I mean, the average cinema ticket here is about $12 to $15 for a movie. Hang on, I'm being shouted at by my wife. How much is it? Well, they did charge us $18. Yeah.
I think it's mean-spirited to charge per person as opposed to per car.
People would definitely take advantage of that in that situation, but
yeah, would there be anyone who would take? I suppose people would pile into one car. No, you're right.
Yeah.
I think it just feels to me like we're charging per pair of eyes that are looking at this screen, as opposed to, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like they're on a ferry where they actually have, like, you know, have weight that has to be like, you know, bore, and then, you know, they have to travel somewhere and use, you know, power. I mean, they're just sitting there.
It feels like if you could go into Cine World and say, I would only like one seat, even though there are two of us. We will be sitting on the same seat. They should be like, well, you know, you're not going to be able to see it. You're like, that's all right.
I don't think you understand how this works. I mean, like, some people do just pull up and watch through the windshield of the car, but most people, and I do mean most, will reverse into the space, unload maybe 3 or 4 camping chairs, break out a cooler full of beer and food, and sit there.
Got you.
Which, when I have kids, I'm definitely doing. I'm going to let them run wild, and I'm going to watch a movie. That's fine. We do that, and the sound's terrible. It's coming through your speaker, so it's mono, and it sounds like something you're watching, like a pirated movie. And the screen is painted white, but there's generally like some bird shit on it. So like it's badly screwing it up whenever the projection's kind of off to the right a little bit. So if there's text, you're missing part of that. But it, you know, you're paying like $3 for a movie. What do you want? And it's a new release, so I don't complain, and I really enjoy the atmosphere. It's kind of nice.
When I picture it in my head, I'm picturing like a red Cadillac without a roof, and like a guy with curly hair and a Letterman jacket sitting next to a girl in like a pink puffy prom dress with bunches. Is that not?
No, it's generally every second car has their windows up, hotboxing weed, and they just smoke all night. Right. And you can smell it as you pass each car. And every other car is a Mexican family who are just looking for a cheap night out. And they're just sort of eating churros and drinking beer. And there's like, you know, like the mom's the one having to stay sober and drive them all home.
Does that constitute a racist card?
Yeah.
is that two this week? Okay.
I don't know if it's technically racist. I mean,
this just, like, I mean,
I'm feeling a bit too tired to actually make the decision, so I'll let that slide.
Okay, is it about time to wrap up then?
I'm less sensitive to that because, you know, Scotland doesn't really have a, you know, a Mexican population of, you know, statistical, you know, note, so, you know, it's not one that really, like, you know, pricks up my racism sensors.
I think they're Mexican because it's in the city of industry, which has a high population of Mexicans. If that makes you feel any better. Yeah.
No, I mean, that's absolutely fine. I'm just, I don't have, like, you know, a kind of an American vocabulary of, you know, things that you don't say, really, you know?
Okay. I don't either, so we're okay, even though I live in America. The opposite of that is the Arclight, or the, is like the theater to go to. It's everything's really preened. You're asked to not use your cell phone during the like, if someone will come out, stand in front of you and say, "Hi, tonight's movie is this, the running time is this. I'll remind you that there's no cell phone calls or text messages during the film.
I'm on board with that. That's cool with me.
Sunny World have started doing that.
Popcorn and drinks, that's different. Phones, no. That's not cool.
Yeah.
If someone's sitting there, like, you know, going through their texts on Facebook or something, I'd get the fuck out. You know?
Yeah.
I've got no tolerance for that whatsoever.
I have
They're
one
bad
level.
People.
I've got one level of tolerance for it. Like, I can't stand if there's a distraction like that. Like, if there's someone on their phone either talking on their phone or talking to each other or looking at their phone, it ruins the film for me. Like, I will sit there and go, you know, either I'm going to say something to them and then, you know, be thinking about the thing that I said and whether or not they're going to get me later, or I'm not going to say anything and think about the fact that I should be saying something. And either way, like, the film I'm watching, it happened during Life of Pi. I was watching it going, this is the worst.
Oh, you told me this. Tell Martin.
Oh, it was terrible. Like, there was, like, wee dicks down at the front, and they were, I guess they were throwing coins, like,
why did they go to Life of Pi?
I know. I actually sat in front of as well to a group of 3 teenagers who went in to see Paul Thomas Anderson's The Master. And I was like, I mean, it's like that cliche, what did you think? But I do have one level of tolerance where not only do I'm fully on board with these people talking, but I would rather they talk than they don't talk, and that's when there's an enforcer in the cinema, like somebody who's not going to take this shit anymore, and he's decided that he's going to go up to them and say, "You better put that fucking phone down or I'm going to smash," you know, like, "Shut the fuck up." That is, like, better than the film. If that happens, then I'm like, oh, I can't believe my luck. It's like Jeremy Kyle just happened.
I only had to do that twice.
You should have been at the Cineworld when I went to see Redacted, because someone threw, like, kind of a wee, like, kind of sugared, like, kind of jelly sweet, and, like, he threw it, like, over from like the back kind of rows, and it landed in like someone's popcorn in front of me, and I was like, well, this is the Glasgow Film Festival, what the fuck are you doing throwing jelly around? And I stood up, yeah, and I turned around and I said that to him, and I just stared at him for a while, and he seemed to decide that it was, you know, it probably wasn't the appropriate, you know, forum for throwing jelly at people.
Yeah.
And you know, he proceeded to not throw any more jelly at people, but it was weird. I was like, what the fuck did you come to Redacted for?
Yeah.
To throw jelly?
I've had it the other way around. I went and saw a film called Dear Molly, I think it's called. It was made by the guy who made the Blair Witch, one of the guys who made the Blair Witch Project.
Mm-hmm.
And it was pretty empty screen, but like Emma and I were sat, we were sat in a row to ourselves, and there was a couple in front of us, like diagonally opposite me, and I literally, like, I had no idea that I was bothering this guy, but I kind of just, and if anyone were to know me, like, in public, I'm very mild-mannered, like, I would never intentionally encroach on anyone's space, but I kind of adjusted myself, and he sort of just whipped round and goes, "Do you want to stop fucking kicking my chair?" And I was like, I was frozen like a statue, like not even like in fear that I was going to get into a fight with this guy. I mean, clearly that's what I should have been feeling. But it was more just like disbelief that something I had done had affected him that much, mm-hmm, that he could whip round and say that to me. It was like, it was really shocking. And, you know, I'm not so much anymore, but I was quite into the Christian thing then. So, like, the whole way through the film, I was, like, torn in this, like, this moral qualm of, like, I need to say something to him. I need to approach him after this film. And I will either scream at him or I will pray for him.
That'd be brilliant. That'd be so great if you had it done at the end of the film. I know we had a bit of an aggressive encounter, but I'm praying for your soul. Yeah. I just hope that someday you can, you know, come to, you know,
yeah,
an understanding of your place in the world, yeah, and be content with that.
You should just scream at him. You should just scream at him that you're going to pray for him.
I'll pray for your soul!
Can you imagine how shaming that would have been, though, if I did that to him? Oh, there is another one. I don't know why. Oh, no, just wrap it up. There was another story.
You can save them for like other, yeah, you know, okay, editions.
So, as usual, we're far off subject. So that's
I think we kept it pretty tight. I mean, we got a good solid, what?
We got an hour out of that. That was just,
yeah, we got
minutes,
a good solid hour of Pixar, and then, you know, some, you know,
15 some minutes of cinema etiquette.
Yeah, that's important. We care about it, you know?
I do care about it. Well, just as a counterpoint to the drive-in theater, really quickly, the Arclight and the Landmark Theater in Santa Monica are really upscale fancy. I went to see a documentary there, Sarah Polley's masterful stories we tell, and I walked into the cinema, and every seat was a couch. And I just felt like, wow, I've made it in life. I've arrived. You get a couch, and if you go in the front row, you get a footrest too. And it's just, like, it was just so lush and, like, beautiful. And they weren't all cramped together. It was only, like, 10 couches in this one huge room and perfect sound. And, you know, it's like, wow. So that's, like, a counterpoint. But you'll pay, like, you'll pay a premium for that ticket. It's expensive. And from where I am, it's a long drive. So I don't do that often. I'm quite happy just to see mainstream Hollywood films in bad quality for volume more than anything else. And I'll just wait for
seeing. I disagree with that. I think you should be watching documentaries, like sitting on a small, uncomfortable office chair in a basement on like a 14-inch, like Sony Trinitron portable on VHS.
Yeah.
So Glass University viewing room is just like a series of cubicles with like a. It's almost quite pervy. I don't know what it is about it. It's just you go in your little cubicle and you watch your little film, and you know you're given a sense of pseudo privacy, and you leave. It's like it's. Yeah. It wasn't very nice, and yet I spent more time in there than anyone else, I'm sure. So I don't know what that says about me. Okay, once again, off subject, sorry about that. Thank you for tuning in to Film Interrupted, my name's Nick. I'll try again.
No, it's not.
I was going to give you a cue there, Nick, you see what happened?
I just got schizophrenic. That happened, and that was weird.
That was weird, I don't know what to say about that. I'm trying to get this cooling, it's not working.
Yeah, I mean, you need to work on your sense of self if you're that worried about what people in the GFT think of you when you leave a film and you're co-opting someone else's identity, you know?
So, just going to give that try again. Thank you for listening. My name's Jack.
My name's Martin.
My name's Nick.
Thank you very much, and until next time.
See you soon. It's been a pleasure.
Take care. Take care, fellas. Thank you for listening to Film Interrupted. If you want to contact us, we can be reached at Film Interrupted on Gmail, Tumblr, Facebook, and of course iTunes. If you'd like to contact us on Letterboxd, I can be found under TechnoSnob303, Martin under Martino Heat, and Nick under Nick Edie. Nice handle, Nick.